Okay, we are switched on now. Okay, so Israel says, what about the final? Okay, and the latest version of the webpage says, absolutely no in-class final exam. Take-home final will be available on the web on Wednesday of final exam week, and it'll be due on Friday of final exam week. Precise timing will work out. I'll try to get it up there as early as possible on Wednesday. And I'm guessing it'll be due Friday afternoon. If you want to send it in electronically to Troy, that's okay. The physical copies, if you turn them in, we'll arrange, we'll figure out what the right time is, but it'll be something like by 3 o'clock on Friday in room, what do I want to say, in Sequoia Hall, the undergraduate office. Yes, go. June 14th is a Sunday?
Yeah.
Have I been using last year's calendar? Is that anybody got a real calendar?
June 12th is Friday.
Ah, okay. I believe you. So what we meant was, thank you, Wednesday, June 10th. Thank you. And to Friday, June 12th. Who knows what we were thinking? June 14th is Flag Day. Hey. Okay, so I apologize. I stand corrected. So on Wednesday, the 10th, it'll be up on the web. It'll be due on Friday. I'm thinking if you want to turn in hard copy, it'll be due by 3 o'clock in the undergraduate office in Sequoia Hall. Does that make sense? Okay, and it'll look like a take-home exam. It'll be a little longer than your take-home midterm, not twice as long, certainly. It will cover material during the last couple of weeks that we haven't had a chance to cover in exams yet. It'll also cover material for earlier in the quarter. So in particular, the issue of futures markets and the social choice material we're going to go over the next week will definitely be on there. Okay, on social choice, let me mention, you don't have any more problem sets due, but if you wanted to do a practice, if you wanted to practice problems in the social choice theory, the area we're going to be going over for the next week, here are some sample problems. And thank you very much for pointing out the calendar. It's obviously, someone was asleep at the switch there. We won't name any names. Okay, other points. Okay, so the issue we're going to be looking at for the next several lectures is what's known as the theory of social choice, or social choice. It's essentially the middle ground between economics and political science, where we try to sort out how groups make decisions. And the underlying motivation here is that we often think of correct allocation policy as somehow promoting a social welfare function, trying to get the best deal we can for everyone. And so one notion is, well, maybe you should just take the sum of people's utilities and try to arrange things to maximize the sum of their utilities. And that's a very old-fashioned notion. That's essentially 19th century utilitarianism. And a very fundamental question is, where could such a norm come from? Okay. And so one notion would be, well, think of a voting mechanism. Okay, so here's a long-standing paradox of voting. Due to the Marquis de Condorcet, or first written up by the Marquis de Condorcet, in what would be the 18th century. Remember the period of the French Revolution. the Marquis was rather curious about how group decisions would be made during the revolution. Eventually, he died, as the story is, he died in prison, but probably not from the guillotine. Okay, so he led a colorful life. Okay, so here's Condorcet's example. Suppose we just do majority voting over pairwise alternatives. And suppose you have the following ranking. So there's voter number one who prefers A to B and B to C. There's voter number two who prefers B to C and C to A. And voter number three who prefers C to A and A to B. Okay, and it's useful before we go too much farther to draw a little picture. Suppose we have those three possibilities arrayed linearly. So A, B, C, left to right. And we represent call it the utilities of each of the households, each of the voters. So voter number one favored A over B and B over C. So his utility was straight downward sloping. Voter number two preferred B to C and C to A. Okay. And voter number three, let's go back and check. Voter number three preferred C to A and A to B. Okay, so let's so voter number three prefers C to A and A to B. Okay, so actually, well, let's draw voter number three a little differently. Beg your pardon. Let's fill things in here properly. Okay, so there's voter number three. Okay, and there's an interesting geometric difference here between voters one and two and voter three. Voter number one has a peak on the left and it goes straight down. Voter number two has a peak in the middle and goes down to either side. Voter number three has two peaks, a mini peak on the left, a grand peak on the right, and a low point in the middle. We'll come back to that. So the red line and the magenta line represent what are known as single-peaked preferences. And the green line, voter number three, looks like a failure of single-peaked. That is to say, there are two local maxima and a trough in the middle. And we'll see that that actually turns out to be an interesting distinction. Okay, so, but let's look at the decision-making that this group makes. So you ask, well, suppose we had to choose between A and B for by majority vote. Well, let's see. Household 1 prefers A to B, and household 3 prefers A to B. So we're 2-1 preferring A to B. And what about if we had to choose between B and C? Well, household 1 prefers B to C. Household 2 prefers B to C. So we're 2-1 preferring B to C. And you say, well, if we have transitive preferences, we know what rationality we usually associate with transitivity. So if you have transitive preferences, A preferred to B preferred to C, that must mean that that C is preferred to A. I beg your pardon, A, let's try that again. A preferred to B preferred to C, that must mean that A is preferred to C. That would be rational behavior. If A is better than B and B is better than C, A must be better than C. That's transitivity, it's rationality. But let's take a look at the vote. Suppose we have a pairwise vote, A versus C. Well, household one does prefer A to C, but household two and household three prefer C to A. So we can get a majority vote in favor of C to A. Okay, so what's happening is we've got a cyclic majority. This is essentially irrational behavior. This group will keep chasing around trying to find a consensus, and there's no best point. Okay, so this looks like, so majority voting over pairwise alternatives leads to apparently irrational behavior or non-optimizing behavior. Okay, so that's the puzzle. And the question then is that just kind of a curious anomaly? Is that a mistake? Or is that really systemic? Is that something that that is in the nature of the case? And the Arrow Theorem says that it's really inherent in group decision making. It is not possible to avoid it. Okay, so what we're going to do is use the classic proof of Amartya Sen, we'll deal with only strict preference. So suppose that on the space of alternatives, everyone has strict preference on one versus another. And let's see, let's not do all the notation just now. Let me try to summarize this. Okay, so what we're looking for here is a group decision-making procedure that will work on all possible mixes of preferences amongst households. So we say some people are vegetarians, some people are carnivores. We take any random mix of them. We want a group decision-making mechanism that will fit any mix of individuals. We'd like it to come to rational behavior. So we want the eventual group preferences that come out of the group decision-making procedure to fulfill rationality. Okay. One way you could do that, of course, would be to simply appoint a dictator. Because the dictator, if he starts out with transitive preferences, and he just says, here are my preferences, that's the way the world's going to work, well, that'll work. So we want a procedure that's non-dictatorial, and we want a procedure that's responsive to individual preferences. So responsive in the sense that if everyone prefers X to Y, then the group will prefer X to Y, or the group preferences will prefer X to Y. And and there's a reason for that. One way you could avoid the non-transitivity of group decision making would simply be to have a transitive rule that was just imposed from the outside. You say, well, if the transitive rule is imposed from the outside, it's certainly transitive, so it's rational, but it's not responsive. Okay, and so there's an easy way out of the non-transitivity. It's by making the rule unresponsive. And here's the trickiest property. So it goes by this very long name, independence of irrelevant alternatives, which sounds like a lot. But what it, and we'll go through that more formally, but what it says is when your group is deciding between a pair of alternatives, well, if we're all going to have ice cream, should it be strawberry or chocolate? Okay. When the group is deciding between a pair of alternatives, it's only the elements of that pair that count in making the decision. Your preferences for vanilla do not count when you're choosing between strawberry and chocolate. Okay. And there's a reason for that. Or if we eliminate that rule, that restriction, there's an obvious decision-making procedure that works. It's what's known as the Borda count. Let me write that out. But it's very simple. So I have forgotten who Mr. Borda was. But it's very simple. It's a weighted voting procedure. So if there are five alternatives, your favorite gets five votes, your next most preferred gets 4 points, and so forth. And then over the group, we just add up those weighted votes. Whatever alternative gets the highest number of weighted votes is the winner. And the preference ranking for the group is simply the greater than ranking on weighted votes. And because the greater than ranking is transitive, the group social ranking will be transitive. What's wrong with that, or what that does not fulfill, is the independence notion. Because there's a difference between preferring chocolate to strawberry, where chocolate is number one and strawberry is number five, versus preferring chocolate to strawberry, where chocolate's number one and strawberry's number two. Your weighted votes come out different, and the group decision comes out different. So that's an example of a perfectly intelligent this group decision-making mechanism that does not fulfill the independence condition. Okay, so the arrow theorem then is, suppose you have a group decision-making mechanism. And what is the group decision-making mechanism? The mechanism F, that's a function F, that aggregates all individual transitive preferences into transitive preferences for the group. We say, well, let this group decision-making mechanism F satisfy this responsiveness condition, the weak Pareto principle, the independence of irrelevant alternatives, that when you're choosing between a pair, it's only your pairwise preferences that count, unrestricted domain, that your group decision-making mechanism has to work on all complicated arrays of preferences. Suppose the number of households, number of voters you got is finite, and there are at least three alternatives you're choosing among. Then there is a dictator. Or conversely, it is not possible to find a group decision-making mechanism with a finite number of voters and at least three alternatives that satisfies all four conditions. So typical of well-constructed mathematical theorems, we notice that if you eliminate any one of the four conditions, you can find a successful transitive group decision-making procedure. So the notion of only having as weak assumptions as you can get away with is fulfilled even here. Okay, so that's the grand theorem, that transitivity leads you toward dictatorship, or restricting your democracy to a restricted class of preferences, and the theorem that we'll develop a week from today is known as the single peaked preferences theorem, due to Duncan Black, which says, can I get back? No, that's not it. Okay. The technology has defeated us again, but let's just draw the picture. So the Black's theorem on single peak preferences is, if you can always characterize preferences as looking like this, that there's just one high point for every voter, then you, majority voting on pairwise alternatives gives you transitive group preferences. Conversely, if some of your preferences are double peaked, you may have a problem, or it is not possible generally to prove transitivity of group decision making. All right. So the good news is single peaked preferences save democracy. The bad news is the arrow possibility theorem absolutely scuttles democracy. Okay. So here's what we're going to do. We'll develop this family of assumptions to make them clearer, and then we'll Senn's proof goes in the following way. He defines a concept of a decisive set of voters, and he said, "Well, if you give me a list of voters who always get their way in the group decision-making procedure, then they're decisive." And what we'll show then, and it gets a little technical. I apologize for that. What we'll show then is that if you have a decisive set on one family of alternatives, that this notion of transitivity of group preferences is very powerful. It gives us decisiveness on any proposition. Okay, well, that's not so bad. So what we discovered, and this is not surprising to you. You know that if you have a majority rule situation, if you have a majority, it's not only decisive on one proposition versus another, it's decisive on any pair of propositions you care to name. Okay, so that's not too surprising. What's remarkable is the tyranny of the transitivity result, which says, suppose you've got a decisive set, we can always break it up into two disjoint, non-empty subsets, one of which is decisive. And you say, well, that doesn't sound right, but it's the consistency of transitive choice that does that for you. So that's the group, that's Senn's group contraction lemma. What it says is, suppose you had a majority and it was decisive. Well, the logic of decision making has this property that you can cut a few people out of that majority, may no longer be a majority, but for consistency, you're going to have that group is still going to have to be decisive. Okay, at that point you're done, because what you've got is you can always cut down the size of your decisive set until there's only one person left in it, and he's your dictator. Okay, so that's the logic of the Senn proof. Okay, so let's start with a little notation, I think there's a write-up. If you look on your web page, one of the supplementary readings is the biography of Kenneth Arrow, and there's a long discussion there of the drama surrounding the Arrow possibility theorem, because this is regarded as one of the kind of cornerstones of modern welfare economics, and like half the guys in our political science department specialize in this family of issues. Theoretical studies of voting. So it's a big deal. Okay, so little notation. X is the space of our alternative choices. So it's, it'll be something like chocolate ice cream, vanilla ice cream, strawberry ice cream, or Bill Gates gets all the money and the rest of us are poor, or something like that. So whatever you're choosing among, there should be at least three elements there. They should be distinct. And capital Pi is the space of transitive strict orderings on X. So the notion is everyone in the room knows about the things in X, and they figure out what their preference is on them. And to keep our analysis relatively simple, we're going to ignore indifference and just go with strict preference. Okay. What this says is we're going to consider any conceivable strict preference ordering on X. So if there's some guys who like chocolate better than vanilla and vanilla better than strawberry, there's going to be somebody else who we have to consider who likes strawberry better than chocolate and chocolate better than vanilla. Any conceivable mix of orderings is going to show up here. And H is going to be our set of households, our voters. And so there should be a finite number of those, positive integer. And then pi to the power h, that's the h-fold Cartesian product of the space of preferences. So what is that saying? It's saying in pi to the power h, we consider any mix of possible arrays of individual preferences. So in pi to the h, there are going to be some points where everyone agrees chocolate is better than vanilla and vanilla is better than strawberry. There are going to be other points where there's a range of preferences, and there's going to be other points where there's absolute unanimity in the precisely opposite direction. And so this is completely agnostic. It's saying there are no right preferences. There is no unanimity. Everything's open for discussion. Okay. In the conventional terminology or the old-fashioned terminology, we look for a mapping from pi to the h into pi, and that's what Arrow called an arrow social welfare function. I think we might call it a political constitution. What it says is we're looking for a decision-making mechanism, f, that will take an arbitrary array of individual preferences, one for each person in the society, each of those individual preferences being transitive, and turn it into a transitive ordering for the society. And of course, the transitive ordering for the society will depend on the individual orderings. That's what the Pareto principle says. But it's got to be consistent. It's got to be transitive. Okay. So the mappings are obvious. If you pick out a point in here where everyone prefers chocolate to vanilla, well, then under the Pareto principle, society will prefer chocolate to vanilla. What's tricky is how you treat situations where there's a difference of opinion. Okay. Sen's notation is a little subtle, but it's not complicated. In Sen's notation, P sub I is the preference ordering of household I. So if household I prefers chocolate to vanilla, we'll say chocolate PI vanilla. Okay. Then when we put curly brackets around PI, that's an H-fold product of P's. That's a list, one for each household, of household preferences. And then when we have a P without a subscript, that's the social ordering that came out of F for the profile of individual preferences, curly bracket PI. Okay? Okay, so P without a subscript is the social ordering that's based on the mapping of F on the individual orderings. Okay, and so questions on notation? Okay. So we're going to state those four big assumptions that that we make of weak Pareto principle, unrestricted domain, non-dictatorship, and independence of irrelevant alternatives. Oh, and something you didn't ask but should be obvious by now. You don't have to remember all this precisely because your exams are open book. Okay? So just make sure you print out the notes. Okay, so unrestricted domain is two pieces. It says we're not going to prejudge any individual's preferences, and we're not going to prejudge the mix of individual preferences that goes into the group. So pi, the space of individual preferences, has to be any logically possible ordering. It has to admit any logically possible transitive ordering of the propositions X. Okay? And much more powerful, pi to the H-fold Cartesian product of pi, the space of preference profiles, as we call them, the arrays of preferences across individuals, that has to admit any possible mix of any possible individual profiles. So there's going to be some mixes where everyone's a vegetarian. There's going to be some mixes where everyone's a carnivore. There are going to be the more interesting mixes where they're randomized. The notion is that we need a group decision-making mechanism that's powerful enough to deal with all of those all of those possibilities. Okay. Questions on that? Okay. Non-dictatorship says, in your population, there is no single individual who has the property that the group decision will always be the same as his personal decision, or that the group preference will always be the same as his personal decision. But there's a limitation on that. There should be no such person for arbitrary points in the space of preference profiles. So it's perfectly possible that you have what Duncan Black would call a median voter, a guy who's kind of in the middle of everyone's preferences, and he gets his way when there's 51% of the population agrees with him. Okay, but that can't be true for arbitrary points in the space of preference profiles. If everyone turns against that guy, everyone else's preferences turn against that guy, he still can't be getting his own way. So this does not deny that there are some people who some of the time are representative of group preferences. What it says is there can't be one guy who always gets his way independent of everyone else's preferences. Okay, that's non-dictatorship. We'll follow up on this on Friday. See you then. Oh, and if you didn't get your midterm back, come up and see me, and we'll